The Break Store. Unique branded gifts for the holidays, birthdays, or just because. Visit us at www.thebreakstore.com. Hit the right black get in touch button.
Welcome to a new podcast show about stuff. It's the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. Here's your host, Stephen Davis.
Welcome to this week's edition of the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. Welcome, welcome, welcome. My guest this week is a legendary singer, dancer, TV star, and yes, she's a podcast host also. Her name is the great Michelle Shelley Clark White. Welcome, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. This is fun.
How's everything out in California? How's the weather?
Oh, really nice. We make people mad and jealous who are back east.
Today's a great day here in Brooklyn, where you got your start in life at.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you're in Brooklyn? Oh, that's great.
Not too far from the Fort Greene Projects. There was quite a few people that went on to have wonderful careers that came out of Fort Greene Projects, such as Anthony Gordine from the Little Anthony and the Imperials, Bernard King from the Knicks, and his brother Albert. They all came out of the Fort Greene Projects.
Okay. Now I learned something.
What I want you to do is to introduce yourself and then start off talking about how you got started in life.
Okay, introducing myself would be easy. I'm Michelle. I was named Michelle because my mother is Russian Jew. All of our Russian Jewish relatives wanted a very popular Russian name called Masha. And my father wouldn't hear of it and said, no, she's going to be Michelle. So my mother had to get very clever. She didn't upset her people. So she said, well, we'll call her Michelle. That's why my name has that A in it. And it's Michelle. My brother started calling me Shelley early on. As a child in the projects, we had a piano. My mother is a concert pianist. She would sit down and play. And at 2 years old, I would hum along to whatever she was playing and make up my own words and lyrics and start babbling and singing along. One day she said, oh my God, Eddie, my father, Eddie, come here. This girl has perfect pitch. Listen to this. So I'm just sitting on the floor and he said, oh boy, my father being the pimp entrepreneur, he's done everything in life. He was a numbers runner, but he knew talent. Come here, you, we're going to teach you some songs. So they did that. I entered into a pageant and singing little songs like, how much is that doggy in the window? And, oh, never smile at a crocodile. I guess I was a hit. He said, okay, we're going to expand a little. I'm going to teach you some dance routines and bring your brother into the act. I have an older brother, rest in peace, Ilya Clark. He's got a Russian name as well, Ilya. Like Ilya Kuryakin, the star, Man from U.N.C.L.E. My mother was very much in love with a poet and a writer. She's a writer also. His name is Ilya Ehrenberg. He was a poet, a writer. He was from Russia. She loved the name and said, we'll name him Ilya, which was such a blessing and a curse for him. No one could ever pronounce it. Yuya and Duya and is Isla here in school? Poor kids. He eventually changed his name to Eddie, but I always called him Ilya.
I want to know something. When you were growing up as a Black American and Russian mixed together, how was it in terms of growing up? How did people respond to you and how did you feel?
It was against the law for interracial marriages at the time. I was going to school catching hell, not so much from the kids, but from the teachers and the faculty. I would notice that every time my mother left, like an open house or something like that, they would have issues with me. As a kid, I noticed, she wasn't like this before my mother came. So I talked to my parents. I said, look, I'm having issues when she comes to school. Mm-hmm. And I called my father. I said, maybe you should come to the open houses in the future. Sure enough, when that happened, no more issues.
How did the atmosphere change for you when you moved from Brooklyn to Los Angeles? How did people relate to you?
When we came out to LA, it had to be 1957. We followed the Dodgers. The Brooklyn Dodgers became the LA Dodgers. And then here we come. And it was a little bit easier. I had still some bullying when she came to the school, but out here, people were a little more accepting. When we got famous, it didn't matter so much. people were like, okay, that's fine. These are the Clark kids. We were in private school a lot when we started performing in New York. But back to what you were saying, when we came out to LA, it was better. It was just minor bullying, but not as bad.
Tell me about your father.
My dad, Eddie Evans Clark, was from Barbados.
What part of Barbados? Bridgetown?
You know what? I cannot remember what he said, rest his soul. He's not with me to remind me anymore, but I know his mother's name was Isabel Graves. I never got a chance to meet her. And his father was Colvin, C-O-L-V-I-N. And they tell me that he or his brother was the police chief of Barbados for some time.
When did your father come to the United States?
He came here, it had to be late 30s, early 40s, something like that. And he met my mother working, making machine gun parts for the war. He was standing next to her in the assembly line.
He wasn't paying attention to his work, was he?
Not over and told her, I'm going to get with you. I'm going to marry you before the week is out. And she said, how dare you speak to me that way? And that's exactly what he did. He got with her before the week was out, and then they got married. They were the only interracial couple around Harlem and Brooklyn at the time. So he had a temper, so they had to be careful because people would set him off, call her N-lover, the N-word lover. He would get in fights and go to jail, but they wouldn't leave each other. They stuck it out.
So now, we're still in Brooklyn, and your father and mother discover that you have the perfect pitch. And then what happened?
They start teaching me songs and dances, and they go, let's see what the older brother can do. So they paired us together. We were great. We were doing routines. He was throwing stuff at us that adults were doing at the time. We couldn't do homework before we rehearsed an hour every single day. As time went on, we started being booked in fantastic places. I don't know how he did it. He was a Black man handling his business. He went to the Apollo Theater. What kids do you play the Apollo Theater? None. We were the only kids doing three shows a day and four on Saturday. We were doing better. So our lifestyles improved. We moved to Manhattan and there was an audition for 200 dance teams, kids. So we went to Broadway. It was called House of Flowers. Auditioning for that, the Hines kids were there, Gregory and Maurice. A lot of kids whittled down to them and another one. And me and my brother, the producers came to my father and they said, we like your kids the best. The House of Flowers was a house of ill repute. Every prostitute had a name, Violet, Daisy, this and that. And in the old days, it was a prostitution house in the islands, in the Bahamas or in the West Indies. They said, this role calls for two little boys who take care of the prostitutes in this house called the House of Flowers. Pearl Bailey was the madam, and Diane Carroll was her first job ever. She auditioned. She was 18. She got that role. They said, we need two boys. My father said, oh, that's all? You want two boys? And they said, that's what we need. So he takes me into the bathroom, shaves off all my hair, brings me back to the producers. You want two boys? Boom, you got them. You're hired. If that ain't a pimp entrepreneur, I had hair down to my waist.
How did you feel when you got your hair cut off?
I was in tears. And he said, suck it up. We about to get paid.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny.
I remember trying to look real mean because I figured if I looked mean like a boy, he would stop cutting. It didn't work. He just kept at it. He kept at it and at it. And then look, his hair, it's going to grow back when you need it. But right now, let's just do this.
You don't need it. We need this job. When you met Pearl Bailey, what was she like?
I remember I have pictures. She was always very loving. I don't remember that she had kids of her own, but she treated us like we were hers. I remember her just being such a talent, and Diane Carroll as well. I was mesmerized watching her. I said, ooh, I want to be like that when I grow up. Because I'm a girl. I'm not a boy. Joffrey Holder got married to one of the dancers in Carmen de Lavada. That's a bad B, okay? She did this dance coming down as a child. I remember she came down this banister, sliding and ballet and writhing, and set the place on fire. I've never seen a prettier woman that's more talented as a dancer. Joffrey Holder thought so too, because they got married before the play ended. He hurried up.
he must have met your father. I saw Carmen maybe about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, at a reception for the New Federal Theater here in New York, Woody King. She's still lovely as ever.
We went to a big dinner that was a fundraiser for the Alvin Ailey dance school. He came with Carmen, and they didn't know me or Verdine at the time. I went up to him and I said, "Hi, Mr. Holder, you may not remember me, but I was in the House of Flowers with you back in 1955. He looked at me. It just took a minute for it to settle in. And he said, "No, cannot be." And I said, "Yes, my brother was do and I was don't." We offered them a ride home in our limo. We had kept in touch over the phone periodically. And then he passed away. We saw her again at the Kennedy Center Honors. She was in the Kennedy Center honoree. She was lovely. I took a great picture with her and I still have it.
Now, during that particular time, how did it come about that you and your brother got a contract with Columbia Records?
That was very strange.
They weren't taking black folk back then.
They came to the House of Flowers and saw us performing, executives from Columbia. They went to the producer and said, "Oh my God, we love these two kids. We'd love to have them for an album that we're doing called Calypso Songs for Children. It's an album that we're going to use to market it to all the schools in the whole New York area. We're going to train children to sing along and use instruments, percussion, any kind of percussion instruments. They're going to learn to sing along with the Clark kids." Mm-hmm. And the producers said, "Look, we need these kids." They said, "Don't you guys go dark on Broadway every Monday?" And they said, "Okay, knock that album out over the weekend and have them right back." Do you know, we learned 13 songs damn near overnight and cranked it out on this LP. I can't believe those songs are up there on YouTube. Unbelievable. We cranked it out and had to get right back to the Broadway play.
Now, at the same time, you were doing some shows at the Cotton Club or the Cotton Review?
Directly thereafter, when the play ended, we got a call from producers of the Cab Calloway Review saying that they needed a little girl to perform in the show with Cab. So my father rushed me down to the audition.
Your father was Johnny on the spot.
What? He didn't miss a beat. Again, for a black man to just keep at it and not be discouraged. And he was all about his business. Anyway, I go to this audition. And so I'm singing and dancing and they go, "Wow, she's great." They show me some steps. I can't remember the name of the producer of the show, but he was there and said, "This is great." Lo and behold, don't you, when Cab found out they had hired me, he hit the roof. He wanted his daughter to have that role. They had to break it to him very gently that this girl is trained, she's a singer, she's a dancer, she's an actress, she stays on key.
That is key.
We don't want to hurt your feelings. That was also a blessing and a curse. When I was touring with them out on the road for 7 months, he was just so unhappy and angry with me and resorted to doing things like trying to trip me on stage. Maybe I would fall, maybe I would break a leg, and then they could bring his daughter in. People already thought I was his daughter. He had to say, "No, that's just some girl they picked up on audition." He was not happy at all. And Cab, it's no dark secret, was a drinker. And when he drank, his personality turned nastier. I learned to stay out of his way because I knew he wasn't amused with me being in the play. We closed the show together. And that was with, who was in that one? Lonnie Satin from the House of Flowers. Who else? Sally Blair. Are you familiar with her?
No.
She was the Beyonce of the 50s. There'd be no Beyonce without her. This girl was so exciting. She'd kick her shoes off. The men would just go into a frenzy and then collapse. She was, how we say, the bomb. And she was beautiful. I used to go live with her periodically because my mother being white, I could not travel with her in the southern states. Mm-hmm. So Sally would step in as surrogate mom and as well as Cab's chorus girls. They were mothers to me in the southern states. Anywhere else, I could be seen with my mother, but she would be arrested in the south.
Now, I want folks to know, we have only touched the tiny surface, and it seems like a lifetime by the time you were 10 years old. I see that you were the youngest performer at the Palace Theater Mm-hmm. And the Apollo Theater.
And the Apollo.
Tell me about that. What was the performances that you were doing at those places?
The Heinz kids, they were great. I don't take anything away from them. But my father trained us in the way of being able to do ballroom dancing, as well as tap and Afro-Cuban dancing. Plus, we did acrobats. My brother would throw me in the air and I'd flip around three times. He'd catch me. So we were billed because we were performing like adults. I just remember having to sleep on wooden chairs in between the shows. Mm-hmm. And at the Palace, it was not quite as rigorous as the Apollo. They will work the holy hell out of you. And I just remember just being tired a lot because those shows come back to back.
Do you remember the very first time that you were on the Palace Theater? And you walked out and you looked out into the audience. What was your mind?
I remember more the Apollo. The theater was dark out there and you couldn't really see who was sitting. I looked out and said, oh my God, it's now or never. And we have to do this. I would look at my brother and go, are you good? Can you remember all the steps? We were some dancing fools. I remember just being afraid until we hit that stage. And when we did, it was all good. We just left it all out there. We wanted to make my father proud too. We'd always come off the stage. How did we do? How did we do? And it was never perfect. With him, it was always, you missed that step in the middle of the blah, blah. Or Ilya, you should have been smiling more. You're like dumbstruck at first. And then all of a sudden it kicks in and you get with it. That's all I can say.
I was thinking that father seemed to have been the role model for the Jackson father, Joseph Jackson. He must have took a course from your father in terms of how to manage your offspring. So kudos to your father. Tell us a little bit about your brother.
My brother, in honesty, he was not quite as talented as I was in the ways of catching on. Being an instant performer, I would just light up. It would take him a minute to get acclimated. I think he always felt like he was in my shadow a little bit, but that was okay. It made him try harder. He was good in school. He was brainy and I wasn't. His mind was sharp. And so he was a performer, but not quite the A plus that my father would have liked him to be. He had to work a little extra hard to get where I was. No bragging in that sense, but I had a natural innate talent that came a little harder for him. He was my best friend because we couldn't play with other kids. They were terrified we'd fall down, get hurt, and couldn't perform. So we were stuck in the house, just me and him making up games. One of our favorite things was on the TV, you turn off the sound and then you just make up lyrics. You make up dialogue for what you're looking at. Mm-hmm. And we would do that for hours. That was our entertainment because we did not lead a normal childhood.
I see that you have bragging rights over your husband because you were signed to Columbia way before he was.
And he tells people, these gold records back here, she had them before I did. He'll tell people in a minute. I think it made him have respect and it made Maurice afraid, his brother, because he would always say, you think that she may be a little too much for you? And the right answer, yes, she is, but I'm going to learn from her and not be afraid of her.
And that's good. Each one of us have our own talents. And sometimes we try to be somebody else instead of being ourselves. You have to be what you are.
That's right.
When did you find out that you were moving to Los Angeles and why did you move to Los Angeles?
Both of them thought that we're doing great here, but I think that we could get these kids possibly in films if we moved out to California, which was really in his head, Hollywood. That's what he saw. By the time we got out here, I want to say that we were still the Clark kids, but we cutesy era had worn off. Shirley Temple had to make that transition from childhood into that awkward teen stage and beyond. We had a little bit more trouble because we were not the cute Clark kids anymore. The bookings became fewer and slower. So my father just came to us one day and he said, I think that from now on, you kids should do your own thing. I'm getting tired and I can't beat down the doors anymore. Things weren't happening fast enough for him. I looked at my brother. I said, do you want to continue? What do you want to do? He said, yeah, but no more dancing. Let's just sing. So that's what we did. We put a little act together called the Clarks. We were now mid-teens. I started going to LA High. On the weekends, we would perform what they would call those hootenannies. We did that whole battle of the band circuit. He was a guitar player. So it was just acoustic guitar. In LA High, I was a scholarship winner, got to attend USC. I was doing opera then. So I auditioned with two opera songs, O Mio Bambino, Caro from Puccini, and Alleluia Chorus, I believe it's by Mozart. And after the audition, 2 weeks later, I got a telegram and it said, you have been awarded a scholarship to attend USC while you're still in high school. Wow. So I was leaving LA High every day, pissing off teachers, getting on the bus and going to USC and taking lessons from a legendary opera teacher named Alice Mock. If you are in the opera circuit, then you know about her. I mentioned her to Michael Tilson Thomas during the Kennedy Center honors. I sat next to him. He said, Alice Mock, you took from her. She was legendary. But I was coming in hoarse a lot, Stephen. I was coming in hoarse and she was saying, what are you doing outside of here? And I said, I'm singing Hootenanny and club dates with my brother on the weekends. She said, look, you are going to have to take an inventory and find out what you really want to do. And she said, might I make a suggestion? She said, you can't do all that secular music and come in here and get an operatic soprano on. She said, there's not going to be a lot of roles for Negro female soloists, leading ladies in opera. I suggest that you move on and do what you're doing and just do that. And don't try to combine the two worlds. I think you'll do better. Come to find out, Ramsey Lewis had a teacher that told him the same thing because he was classically trained. And his classical teacher told him, look, you're going to do better going off into jazz because you're not going to get a first chair. And we had him on That's My Story, my podcast. Me and him busted up laughing because we had very honest teachers. They pushed us and encouraged us to move.
And how was it going to USC?
It was different because I was still in high school. And so I just remember it was rigorous. You had to be about your business and you had to start note reading, not just you're going to stand up here and sing. Now we're going to give you sheet music and you're going to know what a fifth is and what a third is. You're going to know where to place your voice based on these little dots on the paper. That was very different. That's called music theory. But I'm glad I took it because I needed that for another job that I got later on in life. Going to USC was a real experience for me.
Now, you became an Ikette with Ike and Tina Turner.
That was right out of high school. I don't know if you remember a woman by the name of Ann Kane. She was married to Otis Williams of the Temptations, but she also worked for Ike as a sort of scout. And she did a lot of bookings. Ike was brilliant. He hired all brilliant women to run his organization. It's the first of its kind. I can't even remember how she found me, but she called and said, I'd like to come to your home and audition you, which I had an apartment. She came and auditioned me. It had to be 1965, 66. I graduated LA High 65. She said, let me see you sing and dance. So I did. And she said, oh, fine. You'll do great. You're hired. And I said, oh, great. What's next? She said, you fly out in the morning. Tina was unhappy with some Ikettes. So some got fired on the spot and some Ike fired. So I guess I was coming in replacing somebody. I have no idea who it was. But I was on a plane the next day. I landed and went to my room and started unpacking. There's a bang on the door and it's Ike. And he comes in, I'm Ike Turner. Oh, hi, how are you? And he said, oh, okay, I'm fine. But he's standing there with all his bags. And so I said, what's all that? And he said, that's my bags. I'm going to sleep here tonight. Wait, she didn't tell me about this part.
Was that the audition?
This was the after audition. And I said, look, I'd love to be an Ikette. I was doing fine in LA. And this is not something that I really need. By the way, aren't you married to Tina? In my naive 18-year-old self, but that doesn't have anything to do with anything. And I said, no, it has everything to do with everything. Right in front of him, I started packing my bags again. That was short-lived. I guess I'm out of here. Get for me. And he said, okay, forget about it. You're just a baby. you're a baby. I guess that was supposed to embarrass me. I said, okay, then I'm just a baby. And then he left. And then I had no more situation with him at all. The very next day was rehearsal. I met Tina. The elevator opened up. I stepped in going down to rehearsal. And there she was in the elevator. And she said, hi, I heard about you. I said, oh, okay. I'm thinking she heard I stood up to him. I'm thinking that's what that means. She said, what sign are you? And I said, I'm a Leo, hoping that was the right answer. And she said, oh, we're going to get along just fine. I'm a Sagittarius. We're both fire. We went down to rehearsal and they started showing me the steps. Their jaw dropped when they saw that I was catching on so quickly. Tina said, I want you standing next to me. We never called her Tina. Her name was Dutta. That's all we referred to her as, Dutta, her nickname. I was there with another Iquette named Cheryl and another Iquette named Ann Thomas, who eventually married Ike.
Did you experience or feel any tension at the time that you were there between Ike and Tina?
I did periodically because sometimes our rooms are next door or down the hall. Sometimes you could hear, you know, loud voices and that kind of thing. And I would just turn up my radio. I said, this does not concern me. Whatever was happening, Tina was the quintessential entertainer and performer. And no matter what happened or if she looked battered, she would perform like it was nothing wrong. And so it was just the secret that nobody really talked about.
Did you and Tina keep up through the years?
No, we didn't, because after I was hurt in the bus accident that I'm sure everybody knows about.
I was leading up to that, but you can go ahead and tell that.
I do want to say one thing, that when we performed here in LA, we performed at the apartment. And that was where Tina decided that she was going to end her life and take all the sedatives. I was the Iquette that discovered that she was not well and had overdosed. I yelled, hey, help, something's wrong with Tina. And her head was down. That was just traumatic for me. I said, wow, she's really unhappy and wants to get out of this and doesn't know how. Even as a young woman, I knew that.
Too bad she didn't have Paul Simon back then, right?
Oh,
50 Ways to Leave Your Lover.
The movie with Angela Bassett shows that she started chanting. One of the other Iquettes showed her what chanting and Buddhism was about. My mother was Buddhist. My brother is Buddhist. So I knew that it brought you a level of power and peace. And after she started chanting, she started getting her mojo back. She stood up to Ike. I think she got the confidence to leave after that, but Buddhism played a lot into that for her. She moved to the south of France. We had a chance crossing in Monte Carlo, where she was living at the time. Earth, Wind, and Fire was performing there. We almost met there, but somehow schedules just didn't work out for us to meet. That was some time ago.
But yes. Now you were going to talk about the car accident.
We traveled from city to city, state to state by tour, a bus. The poor bus driver, I think his name was Duke, but he was running the lights at night and Ike was trying to save money and had him driving the bus in the day. And this poor guy was never sleeping. Al McKay, who was Earth, Wind, and Fire's former lead guitarist, Al McKay was in the band and he was my bus seat partner. He was the one that was telling me everything about the review. He was out there before I got there. So he was telling me, this person does that, and that's Rhonda, the road manager, and she's this and that. And she'll carry out Ike's fines. If you miss a step on stage, if you have a run in your stocking, or if you don't shake your hair enough, you're going to get fined. And so he was my mentor. We were tired. Al fell asleep. I said, wake up. Look at Duke. He's falling asleep. Duke was nodding while he was driving. He said, oh, okay, go up there and talk to him. So I go up there and I start talking to Duke, just anything to keep him awake. I got tired and exhausted. I go back to my seat. Soon as I sit down, Duke hits a telephone pole at 55, 60 miles an hour. This bus turns over. I fly out the door. The doors to the bus must have opened. I tumble down this ravine. It's in Wichita, Kansas, in the dead of winter. It's snowing. It's freezing. And I'm unconscious. The next thing I know, I'm 150 feet down in the ravine. I don't wake up. Al is tugging on me, pushing me, saying, Shelly, are you alive? Babe, wake up. I look up and I don't know what's happened. I just know that my face feels swollen. And I said, Al, I have a fever blister. and I have a headache. And he said, no, babe, we were in a terrible accident and you're half dead. I was twisted up like a pretzel. I said, don't touch me. Don't touch me. I was afraid that somebody would try to take my leg and my hand out from behind my head. I said, I have a headache. Can you find me a pillow? I'm delirious. Al takes his jacket off. It's snowing. It's sub-zero temperatures. He balls it up and puts it under my head. That much I remember. I don't remember anything else until paramedics sirens are coming. I go, oh, I'm in trouble, because I figured I'm not getting back on the bus. I'm going to the hospital. The paramedics start unwinding me and I'm just, no, don't stop. And they said, I'm sorry, this is a hell of a way to start the day, isn't it? And they're just talking to me to keep me awake. Next thing I know, I'm in the hospital and there's Tina standing over me crying. She told the doctors, don't give her a mirror. Don't let her see herself. And I'm thinking, ooh, boy, I'm in trouble here. Because I asked them for a mirror and they told me, no, we're instructed not to give you one. My mother somehow finds me in this hospital because it hit the news. She called every hospital in Wichita, Kansas, until they found me. I must have been in there 10 days, 2 weeks, something like that. And the next thing I know, I'm on a plane limping with the crutches going back home.
What was your father doing at this particular period of time in your life? I'm imagining that he was so used to being a manager of you and that he's no longer your manager.
Right. He was just dumbfounded, first of all, about the accident. And you're right, he was not a manager. He was really just a father on the sidelines being supportive at that time. And I just remember him calling, blowing my phone up, asking me, when can I visit? What do you need from this point? I want you to stay off of tours. And I'm like, I got to make money. He was on the outside of my career at that point.
During this particular period of time, I noticed that they went ahead and got more ICATs and kept going. What did they do about you?
Absolutely nothing. I remember Ike calling me one day and said, I need you to sue me for the accident. I said, really? Okay. If you want me to, then I will. I don't know what that was all about, but I remember going to court and having to say what happened and show my bruises. I never understood why he asked me to do that, but I followed his orders and I did. And I don't think I received anything compensation-wise.
So that was a bummer.
I was afraid of the tour buses after that.
And then you went to and toured with Little Richard after that.
Like I said, here comes another tour with a tour bus. And I'm like, oh man, I'm not even healed well from this one. I knew I had to work and I was healed enough to just be a dancer for his tour. Byron Gilliam from Laugh In and from Playboy After Dark, very elegant, tall dancer. He and I were selected to open the show for Little Richard and do two numbers. And then Richard would come out and do, you know, Golly Miss Molly and do his whole thing. But every day, every evening after the show, I say, Richard, can I sing? Can I sing? Can you just let me sing one song? And he would say, because he couldn't say my name, he's Southern boy, I said, okay, Shirley, let me think about it, Shirley. And I would say, it's Shelley. Okay, Shirley. And then the next week, Richard, can I sing this week? Just one number. Let me think about it, Shirley. Shirley, they hate me because I'm beautiful. Shut up.
How was Little Richard? How was your interaction?
You learn so much about him. Excellence. Tina Turner, too. You know, she was just the consummate performer. She would go on, if she had one leg, she would entertain that audience like it was her first night being on stage every night. Richard was the same. I happened to get lucky twice. Back to back, you just pick up what you see. And the crowds loved him. Backstage, I remember he had girls that took care of his hair. He had 8 wigs on the shelf. He had his makeup people. He was a better woman than most women.
Shut up. Get out of here.
Number 2 foundation. That's why I look so good, Shirley. So I always joke for Dean when I see him putting on powder. I go, number 2 foundation.
Now you left Little Richard tour and you went and you were on the Jim Neighbor show.
Back up just a minute because right after that, I started doing sessions. I was doing like 3 and 4 sessions a day. This legendary woman somehow found me named Shirley Mae Matthews, spelled S-H-E-R-L-I-E. Mm-hmm. And if you look her up, her Wikipedia is three times what mine is if you saw mine. This woman has been in the industry. She's a little bit older than me, and she knew Carolyn Willis from The Honeycomb. She said, I'm putting a little group together. Let's do a group. So we called ourselves Willis, Matthews, and Clark. And later on, it was known as the Cover Girls, but it was Willis, Matthews, and Clark. And I met Carolyn Willis. That girl could sing her ass off, okay? She was like the best soprano in the industry. She was killing songs by Aretha Franklin. Nobody should cover those songs if you can't sing. But Carolyn could do it. And I was along for the ride there. We were doing nightclubs and theaters and little places here and there. And one day, Carolyn Willis called me and she said, I sing sometimes with another girl named Edna Wright, and she needs another girl, two girls to sing with her on the Andy Williams special featuring Dionne Warwick and Burt Bacharach. She said her sister Darlene Love is always triple booked and Darlene can't do it. So we're going to come in and save the day. And I said, oh, great. So we go to the Andy Williams special, my first time meeting Edna. And I'm saying all this to say that before Jim Nabors, we have this period in here that we sang on the Andy Williams special. Unbeknownst to me, Edna had told Edward Holland of Holland Dozier Holland to please watch this group. They were hounding her to sign as an artist for their new company. They left Berry Gordy. They had their own company now, and there were no acts on the label as of yet. She said, well, I don't want to be a solo artist. I want to be in a group. And if you like this group, then you can sign this group. We're singing behind Dionne Warwick. We're singing behind Andy Williams, Burt Bacharach. Edward watched the show the next day, called Edna and said, it's a wonderful look. You girls come on in and let's sign some contracts. And you can be the first act on Hot Wax Invictus Records.
And that was the start of the Honeycomb.
When I finally signed, I was the holdout because I didn't want to go. I was afraid that they would be very much like Berry Gordy. I was afraid to sign. And so the two of them went and took another girl. Edward said, no, I want the three that I saw on TV.
But what do you mean by they would be very much like Berry Gordy? You said it, so I had to follow up on it.
In the vein that there were acts on the label that were complaining about royalties and not receiving just due payment for what they were doing and being worked to death, going out on tours, Barry was so complete with his ownership of you. You didn't own your name. You didn't own anything about you. So I said, wow, the same thing is probably going to happen to us. I'm sure Holland Dozier learned a lot of those ways to make sure you have total control over the artist. I was a little bit nervous about that.
You know what that shows, though? That shows that you had been in show business for much longer than the kids that were coming out and signing, and they would just sign their life away just to be able to tell their buddies back home, I'm a temptation.
I got a record deal, mama.
But your daddy didn't raise no fool, right?
I did the Andy Williams special not realizing that this was supposed to lead to something bigger that maybe I wasn't ready for. They had a hard time convincing me. I was traveling and they were calling nonstop and crying in the phone. You're ruining our chances to be famous and in a great group, and they're going to do a lot for us. I held out for, I want to say, maybe 2 or 3 months.
But at the time, though, didn't you have a job with Jim Nabors?
No.
No, you didn't have. When did Jim Nabors come?
Jim Nabors came in after we got signed. We went to Detroit. I spent half my life there. Felt like it, recording. I think we knocked out 3 or 4 albums. I don't know, at least 2. And they started releasing singles that were doing okay, but not great. And they said, all right, you girls go back to LA. But you go to LA and I don't want to see any of your faces on a TV show. I don't want to see any of your faces anywhere, because by the time we hit, you're going to be a fresh-faced group. So I said, okay, fine. When I got back to LA, I started auditioning to get on any TV show. My mother told me, you better go for it. You don't have a whole lot of time out here. We got songs. They're great. They're pending. Nothing's really jumping off. What am I supposed to do? I have bills. I auditioned with about, I want to say, 400 girls for an upcoming TV show called the Jim Nabors Variety Hour. Here's where USC comes back into play. I went through an audition in stages. First, it was singing. Everybody had to sing the same thing. You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. They wanted to take a basic song to see what flavor you could add to that would make you stand out from just standing there singing a song that everybody knows. I passed that audition because, of course, I put my dancing skills in it. And so there was Tina Turner, boom, doing the pony. Mm-hmm. And then so then the next phase of that was sight reading is what they call it. They give you sheet music and you just sing what the hell is on it. But you better know where to place your voice as far as where these notes are. And here again, that's music theory. And that kicked in from USC. And of course, the dancing, of course, came from my father and then Tina and then little dancing for Little Richard. And then the next audition was harmony and music note retention. I'm going to play 10 notes on the piano and I want you to sing them back to me in perfect order. And if you don't sing them back, then you're cut from the audition. So I had to go through that. Then there was an acting phase where you had to do impromptu. I'll give you a script. You're in a grocery store and there's somebody, let me see you react to what happened. Audition number four. And I noticed every time it was getting smaller and smaller until it was down to what they needed, which was four girls, three white girls and one black, and four boys. Three white boys and one black to pair me up with. And we were called the Neighbors Kids. And that's how the Jim Neighbors show came. When that first show hit, I was working 3 days a week. I was getting paid like $800 a week for just 3 days of work. I said, I'm never getting off this. Oh, hell no. And so Edward would call weekly, get off that goddamn show. I see Carolyn, Eddie's mad at you. He said, you got to get off that show. And I said, okay.
And the next week you would be back on.
And one day Eddie calls and he says, Juan adds the song, Y'all Girls. Everything was Y'all Girls. Y'all Girls recorded went to number one. And I'm like, say what? Oh no.
But it was a good decision to make.
Maybe, but I had a sure thing. I'm thinking now it's back to Detroit and it's back to dealing with all of this honeycomb stuff. I went to the producer of our show and I just said, look, I guess I should have told you I'm in a girls group and our song just went to number one all over the world. They looked at me like I had six heads. Wait a minute. You mean to tell me you're signed to us and signed to them? That's Jeopardy and we're going to sue you. And I said, what do I need to do? They said, you're going to have to replace yourself with the perfect person who can sing, dance, act, sight read, harmony retention, note, blah, 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 will approve of that person and then you can leave. I'm like, holy. So I just start auditioning girls and a couple that I thought would pass did not. A girl that saved my life was a girl that I had toured with. She was with the Raelettes. I had toured with her with Dusty Springfield and Bill Medley. And her name is Alex Brown. She is the bomb. She came in and went through all six of those auditions and passed every one. So after that, I was able to fly out back to Detroit. I bless and love Alex today. She was the reason that they released me from my contract.
After you have discovered your song is number one and you leave the Jim Neighbors and you go to Detroit, what happened?
At this point, we know we have to go into intensive rehearsal. So we're there with Charlie Atkins, cranking out a show and being fitted. We had a look. We were fly LA girls. We told them how we saw ourselves and thank God they let us follow through. We had no say-so in anything else, as I talked about earlier, but they let Carolyn Willis do a lot of our background vocal arrangements. And I was happy about that because she was good. But Lamont Dozier, that was his area too. And he was great. So between the two of them, we got great songs. Anyway, so we're cranking out the show. Next thing I know, we're on the road and we're asked to perform on Soul Train. And we are the first artists to kick off Soul Train with Gladys Knight and Eddie Kendricks. The very first artists ever.
Wow, wow. Two of my great friends was William and Edward from the Pips.
Oh.
Yeah, we were great friends, especially William.
We had Charlie's choreography. Charlie Atkins is one of the greats. They stole him from Motown. He called Honeycomb his female Pips. She put in extra work because Charlie would throw a chair if you were messing up his steps.
You go through being a honeycomb. What uh-huh. was some of the highlights of being a honeycomb besides the recognition and hopefully the money?
I enjoyed my camaraderie with Carolyn and Edna. It was like being on the road with your sisters. We had a family love, a family friendship. We would crack up laughing. We made each other's life very cool. I liked performing. We did the Apollo with George Clinton and the Funkadelic. We always chop it up when we see each other. He would say, come down to my dressing room. I'd just sit at his feet and listen to his stories. Always a lot of people around. The Stair Steps were on that show with us. We traveled to the West Indies, Germany, Madrid. We went everywhere.
I didn't really formally introduce, and you didn't introduce. Your husband is Verdeen White, Earth, Wind, and Fire, the bass player, the energetic bass player.
We celebrated 40 years this last New Year's Eve. So we've been at it a while.
Why did the Honeycombs disband?
Everything that I was feeling, Carolyn Willis was too. She felt that we were supposed to get a bigger payoff. She never saw the royalties, as I forewarned. And one day she woke up and said, Shelley, I'm tired and I don't want to do this anymore. I'm going to go home. I remember I was panic stricken because I said, you're going to leave right now? She said, you guys got this. I know Edna's great. She's the lead singer. You guys can find a third girl. You don't need me. I'm not happy. And I just want to go home and resume my life. I was in disbelief. I said, Edna, we're faced with a situation here. Do you want to try to move on with another girl? And so Edna said, yeah, let's start auditions. And so, which we did, I cranked out some of the old people that I had come audition for the Jim Nabors show, some of the same girls, and it didn't work out for us. We did some performances that we had pending and Carolyn was gone. So it didn't work. The chemistry was all gone. But Carolyn was not wrong in what she was feeling. It's just that she did not want to live that facade anymore of just being a honeycomb. And on the surface, that's what you were. And you don't really own your own life. And you're being worked to death because I was tired. So I know she was too. She was starting to become a vegetarian in those days, as I was.
Now, when you left Honeycombs, you were asked to be a Supreme, weren't you?
Oh, yes. Mary Wilson, bless her heart, along the way, we had become friends. While living in Detroit, I sang on a lot of things that Frank Wilson was doing, a lot of projects that he was doing. I'm on Still Waters and the Four Tops and Eddie Kendricks, all the stuff that he did. So she came up to me on some red carpet and she said, Shelley girl, I really need a Supreme. We want you to be in the Supremes. You my first choice. And I said, oh, wow, that's great. Mary, I'm so glad you thought of me. I idolized her and what she stood for. But I was not ready to commit to yet another girls group. I figured, here we go again. And that's all I thought about. I said, as much as I would love to, can you circle back later on if you don't find anybody and come back to me again? But right at this moment, I'd like to just do some solo projects. She was very understanding. Right after that, she called my label mate, who was dating Lamont Dozier at the time. It was happened to be Sherry Payne of the Glass House. That's Frida's little sister. Sherry agreed to do it. Just a lovely spirit. Later on, Sherry went on to perform a little bit with Edna as a honeycomb off and on.
How did you meet your husband? That must be a good story.
I was still singing around town here and there. And I was approached by Ralph Johnson and his partner, Douglas Gibbs, a pianist. They said, we'd like to produce some songs on you. And I said, oh, that's fabulous. Okay. And so we went into the studio. We had three or four songs. Ralph is wonderful. He has always had a great ear. I remember going into the studio and who's sitting there playing all my stuff but Earth, Wind, and Fire. There's Maurice. There's Philip. There's Larry Dunn. And I'm thinking, what in the hell? And how did he get this happening like this? I was floored. I went straight to the phone and I called a friend. I said, you won't guess who is here playing on my session. And they said, who? Maurice White? I said, yeah, Maurice is here. Not him. He said, who? Philip Bailey? Yes, Philip is here. Not him. They said, who? I said, Verdeen White. the best bass player in the world is playing on my session. Do you believe it? And they said, oh no, that's crazy. And I didn't know him. I just knew he was playing on the session. And as time went on, I still had the music. We weren't able to do much with it, but it was still a great project. And I ran into Verdeen maybe 6 months later in a car wash. I said, hey, you played on my session. Remember me? And he said, oh yeah, you're that girl. He said, how did the music turn out? I don't think I heard the finish. I said, okay, come sit in my car and listen to the music. And he sat in the car, listened to all three tracks. And then he said something that surprised the hell out of me. He said, that music is good, but I can do better. Why don't you let me do some songs on you now? And I said, really? He said, yep, I'll take care of all expenses, everything. And I said, wow, okay. So we ended up doing some real great projects together. I did a lot of Denise Williams demos and some of the Emotions. We did a TV show together called Hot City. We were forever doing great projects together after that. That was before we were married.
But that shows you with a little money, you can set up a job for somebody that you really want for a lifetime. Huh?
And he would ask people, who's she signed to? And he would say, oh, I got her signed to me.
It worked. It worked. Well, yeah, as you say, 40 years. What are your future plans? What are you doing now in the future?
Oh, as far as the Honeycomb goes, there is a great chance that we're going to be able to get back out there and start doing some dates. I was halfway propositioned for the upcoming Soul Train cruise, not written in stone, but it's just something to consider depending on where COVID is. And they're doing the Earth, Wind & Fire, and I'll get right back to what you're saying, but they're doing their verses with the Isley Brothers coming up on Easter. So we have to go to the studio. I started the official Honeycomb page. We, of course, are continuing the podcast, That's My Story. It's been great. We've had everybody on there, from Ramsey Lewis to Ray Parker Jr., who incidentally played on all these gold records at the age of 16. We were blessed with great writers, great lead singer. And it was just a time in life when, in the 70s, when things were really great. You know, that's where all the great music comes from, 60s, 70s. One Ads celebrated 50th anniversary last week. So now we have young kids that are being introduced to YouTube. I'm just grateful and happy that the fans still love our music and the friends.
Before I close, I want to give you a chance to talk about a nonprofit that you and your husband have.
A while ago, we always say, there comes a time in life, because we borrow from the people that came before us. Like I said, Sally Blair, Beyonce, we borrow from the people. So there comes a time in life when you have to go from success to significance. And it's incumbent upon you to give back. You have to find where you can do it. It's not the same for everybody. We had a facility that was sitting there, a building. And I said, let's figure out something to do with it. We figured, okay, maybe we can start a foundation that helps kids who are talented or not so talented with music lessons and scholarships. We started our Facebook page as well. Pastor Walter Davis runs the facility. It's turned into a multi-purpose type of thing for the community now, especially since COVID hit. We do meals for the community. Whoever needs, they can stop in and get clothes. There's lots of different rooms. We're focused on taking care of the community. We're happy to be doing it.
How do people contact you? Your website?
Thank you. Right now, we have a great Facebook page, which is called Verdeen White Performing Arts Center Facebook page. Once you put in Verdeen White, boom, it'll come right up. We are both co-founders of it. In the past, we have supported schools. We focus on that.
And can people donate?
Oh, yes. It's on the site. It's on the site. It's probably something like verdeenwhite.org /PayPal, something like that. But everything is on the site at Verdeen White Performing Arts Center Facebook page. Everything is right there.
I tell you, this has been a wonderful time. Thank you so much for joining me on my show. We did talk about stuff, and I like it. And I look forward to seeing more about you, especially in terms of the Honeycombs coming back. Thank you so much, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
And I want you all to tune in next week for another wonderful show. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for tuning in this week. Hope you enjoyed this show about stuff. See you next time.
Jewel. You don't need to know who I am, but you should know why I'm here. My grandpa, Stephen, is an author of a new exciting play called When the Break Happened in Orangeburg County. It's about our ancestors from when the break happened in 1865 until now. Many of my relatives are featured in the play, from my great-great-great-grandpa Stephen to my great-great-grandpa Stephen to my great-grandpa Stephen to my grandpa Stephen. Guess what my uncle and cousin's name are? Stephen. Go to www.thebreakinorangeburg.com to learn more. An online store has been created to honor those relatives and other families with products featuring the Break logo. Go to www.thebreakstore.com to purchase items today and help to produce this play. Please!